Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Katie Burton. In the past decade, a resurgence has happened in the family home. As more people have become foodies and broadened their palates, they experiment with newly available ingredients. Jack Bishop is the editorial director of America's Test Kitchen and has helped put together everything we've wanted to know about the science of good cooking to make sure those newly tweaked recipes are up to snuff. We spoke about the new cookbook, and just because he's an editorial director doesn't mean he's not hands-on in the kitchen.
I'm a wordsmith. I'm first and foremost a writer and an editor, but I am a passionate cook. I've been cooking every day since I was 13, and I love cooking, and I want to get people back in their kitchens and get them to be more successful and to enjoy the time they spend in the kitchen. And I think the way to do that is to, you know, have them producing great food.
And with the science of good cooking, it really gives us some background knowledge that is useful when we step into our kitchens. And I want to take a look at eggs because they seem like such an easy ingredient or food, but at the same time, there's a lot behind them. And in the book, it says butter will help the egg cook.
Yeah, the secret to a great omelet is a little bit of fat, and the fat we like is a little bit of butter. And what's happening is that when you are cooking an egg, it is changing from obviously a liquid form to a semi-solid. I mean, that's why you can, you know, fold or roll up an omelet and eat it with a fork. And the proteins are unraveling. And if they unravel in such a way that they become very tightly enmeshed, they will become tough. And so you will have a very sort of tough, dry omelet. If you add just a couple of small chunks of butter, you know, less than a tablespoon, cut into small pieces, that fat will prevent the proteins in the eggs from overcoagulating. And what you will get is an absolutely tender, really moist omelet that's obviously a little bit delicious as well because you've got the butter in there.
And you say we should salt our eggs while it's in the pan.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of sources suggest to, you know, hold off on salting the eggs until they get onto the dinner plate. And that is a big, big mistake because that salt actually promotes tenderness. And so if you're going to scramble eggs, for instance, what you want to be doing is adding that salt while you are scrambling the eggs and you're adding a little bit of the milk because it weakens the protein network in the eggs so that they, again, they will not overcoagulate and they become much more tender and they're not sort of tough scrambled eggs when they cook up.
Now we are entering into a nice cold season and there's nothing like having homemade macaroni and cheese. And when we are creating that base of cheese, you say starch is definitely our friend.
If you want a really smooth, creamy cheese sauce, you need a little bit of starch. And that can either be in the form of flour, which contains starch, or cornstarch. You know, if you leave that out, you end up with a much more lumpy, kind of curdled, separated cheese sauce. And then, you know, macaroni and cheese is all about having a perfect cheese sauce. And so in that recipe, we really feel like a little bit of flour is the key to making sure that the cheese melts properly and you have a great sauce.
Mm. And I want to talk about something that takes a little bit longer, and that's your beef brisket recipe. And to me, I mean, it's really the gravy that makes a good brisket.
It is, and you need a lot of onions. That's one thing that you need when you make brisket. The other is a lot of time. You know, brisket is one of these tough cuts through the magic of slow cooking that becomes really tender. And so you really want to be able to make sure that you cook your brisket sufficiently. Browning the meat is also a really key step, that browning develops flavor in any food. So we will begin a lot of our meat recipes by browning that roast and then cooking it at a low temperature because that browning reaction only happens at a very high temperature. And obviously you don't want to be cooking a brisket at a high temperature for the entire period, but to begin by browning, you're really developing a lot of flavor, not only in the meat, but that's going to end up in the gravy.
And you talk about the different kinds of ovens and how the heat is affecting our meat. And I mean, obviously it's taking out the water, which can easily make our meat too dry.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, in general, we prefer gentle heat when cooking meat, and that, you know, if you've got a big roast, you're going to be getting much better results if you cook it at 250 or 275 degrees versus cooking it at, you know, 400 degrees. And there are a couple of reasons. One is more heat causes more evaporation of the juices, and obviously that leads to a drier cut. You also get more uneven cooking. So if you've got a large roast in a very hot oven, the exterior portions of that roast are really overcooking. And you're waiting and waiting and waiting for the center to come up to temperature. Meanwhile, the exterior portions of that roast are way overcooked, and that in a low temperature oven, the differential between the center and the exterior of the roast is greatly reduced, and so you're not overcooking large swaths of the meat.
There's another section on spices. I mean, there are so many wonderful dishes that have come across our palates in recent years, and they're full-bodied and full-flavored. And so when we're at home using spices, we buy them out of jars from the grocery store. So how does that compromise the flavor than if we were to use either fresh herbs and spices or grate our own nutmeg?
If you use whole spices, they will have more flavor than ground spices. But the reality is, for most home cooks, those ground spices are so practical, which is why we suggest that you always bloom those spices in a little bit of oil to develop their flavor. So, for instance, if you're making, you know, an Indian curry, you want to be able to cook, after you cook, let's say, the onions and the garlic, add the dried spices, the ground spices, and let them cook in a little bit of the oil that's left in the pan. A lot of the flavor compounds in spices are oil and fat soluble. And so rather than adding them once you've added the liquid, you know, if you've already added the canned tomatoes or the broth and then add the spices don't have time to develop their flavor. And so it's really important whether you're making Indian food, Moroccan food, an American-style chili, you're using ground dried spices to let them cook in a little bit of that fat at some point, usually after you've cooked your aromatic vegetables, to develop their flavor, and then you can add the liquid ingredients.
I feel like people are kind of scared to explore and see what the different flavors of spices do to their food because, I mean, if they put in the wrong one, it can ruin a dish when they're experimenting.
Well, I think, you know, you need to be careful about the hot spices. I mean, you know, you can ruin a dish with too much cayenne. But putting those aside where, you know, you can really just make a dish too spicy, I think the rule of thumb is to start with a small amount. And then if you're not really that familiar with the flavor, try, you know, a small amount, a quarter of a teaspoon, a half of a teaspoon. And then, you know, you can adjust and add, you can add more spice later in the process to ramp up the flavor if you think it's too mild. Or, of course, the next time you make the dish, you can always add more spice. But I think it's always easier to add. It's hard to subtract when you're cooking.
Beans seem to be a staple. You say to brine the beans instead of just soaking them in water.
Yeah, what you're doing is by throwing some salt in there. And the formula is if you've got a pound of beans, you probably have a gallon of cold water. So throw in 3 tablespoons of salt and let them soak overnight. And that salt is going to tenderize the skins and make the beans much creamier and have a really wonderful texture. You know, and after you've soaked the beans, throw out that water and the dissolved salt that's in that water, rinse the beans, and then cook them like you normally would. But if you're going to soak your dried beans, you should be putting some salt in there, and you will get a much better result.
Now, you have a wonderful recipe in here, and it's the lentil salad with hazelnuts and goat cheese. And what a great combination.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And this is the same thing with the lentils. You know, in this case, we're not really soaking them overnight, but we're putting the lentils in a bowl with a couple lentils and a teaspoon of salt, and then covering them with 4 cups of warm tap water and just soaking them for an hour. And, you know, most recipes don't soak the lentils, but you get a much, much better texture, especially if you're making a salad. You really don't want all the lentils to explode because then they become really starchy and heavy. And if you want really intact but creamy, tender lentils, you know, soak them in some warm tap water with some salt for an hour, and then go ahead and drain off that water and cook the lentils, and it's going to be the best lentil salad you ever had.
I've seen the TV show America's Test Kitchen on PBS, and you see all the cooks in the background. Do the cooks come to you and say, I think I have a really great recipe, I think we should try it out and test it, or is it something that the higher-ups say, I am looking for a recipe that contains lentils, or I want something that has hazelnuts in it?
We actually survey our readers. You know, most our recipes are mostly developed for Cook's Illustrated Magazine or for the people who watch America's Test Kitchen TV show, and we ask people what they're interested in. And then it's a collaborative process where we decide, looking at those survey results, we then, everyone who works on the magazine, both the editors as well as the people in the kitchen, sit down and say, okay, let's do this story. And then we start talking about the recipe and say, does anybody have any ideas, any problems they want solved, any solutions they want to offer to those problems? And we are constantly, as a group, talking about these recipes, and I think that's really the strength of what we do, which is that any given recipe may have had 20 different people weigh in with ideas along the way and make that recipe more foolproof and more interesting.
You've been with Cooks Magazine since 1988 and obviously cooking well before then. What sort of trends have you seen in that time?
In the last 4 or 5 years, I think there's been more of a shift back to home cooking. I think for economic reasons, I think for health reasons, I think for people really wanting to have control of what goes into their food. And I think that's really exciting. I've seen a lot more the explosion of ingredients. I mean, if I think about 30 years ago, what you could get in the average American supermarket versus what you can now get. And it's just exciting. I mean, all these great ingredients, you know, a lot of spices and vinegars and oils and things, you know, condiments that sort of give you the taste of the world in your kitchen wherever you happen to be.
It is Cooks Illustrated, The Science of Good Cooking. Jack Bishop is the editorial director of America's Test Kitchen. Jack, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Again, it's The Science of Good Cooking Cookbook. I spoke with Jack Bishop. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.